didn't really know how to use a synthesizer or a sampler or anything like that. So I was just figuring out like all the equipment at CITR that I could get to loop. So whether that was an open, like a Revox reel-to-reel machine, whether it was cart machines. Once we had mini disc, I figured out that certain mini discs had seamless loops and others did not. So you had to figure out which one that was and make sure you had the right one. But the holy grail of looping was a really big deal at that point, I remember.
It is a golden age of looping these days.
And so also in Vancouver, there's a very strong history of artist-run culture. And so what that means are media arts centers that are started by artists, run by artists, that are funded by public funds, mostly, you know, from the Canada Council for the Arts or other funding that are available either provincially or federally. And what that enables is just a really robust scene for artists, especially at that time when it was really expensive to have your own computer or have your own camera or have your own equipment, your own microphones. So you could be part of an artist-run center and there would be the possibility to borrow or rent things and to take workshops and learn how to do things. And so the Western Front in Vancouver, which is one of Canada's longest-running artist-run centers, and also a place of famous, at least, well, I would say internationally, but certainly in Canada, for all of its video experimentation in the early days of video. The Western Front was a really important place for me to realize that there was this bridge from the radio station into worlds that included sound art and media art. And that's also where I learned how to build a very small 2-watt FM radio transmitter based on the Tetsuo Kagawa plans. I'm happy to talk more about him in a little while. Japanese media theorist who kind of transformed a lot of artists' lives with these very small transmitter plans. And it helped me to realize that the radio that I was making didn't only need to be tied to a broadcast studio. It could really be pulled out of the studio in a sculptural way, in a performative way, in a sort of artist social practice kind of way. And from there, I really started making work really full time as an artist. And because of the Western Front having a long standing connection to Austria, because of also their involvement with Fluxus in the 70s and 80s, and their connections to some of the people who had put together the first radio art program on National Public Radio in Austria that was really dedicated to radio art and not, you know, radio plays or Hörspiel, as is maybe more common in other German sort of traditions. So having that connection gave me this pipeline to become part of what was going on in Vienna at Kunstradio, which is this... Kunstradio, literally meaning art radio, this program on the National Public Radio in Austria. It was a really great example where like an artist-run culture and a community radio station were able to connect with other places internationally that had a similar sort of independent interest but were housed within a larger institution.
And I mean, that's a great place to explain more about what the studio was like and how in Austria... So I take it they had a much longer tradition of radio art. And so how did the studio, what was the difference between that and your DIY scene back at home?
Well, also because, you know, CITR Radio, which has in the meantime also spiffed up its studio incredibly. They have a gorgeous studio at the UBC campus now in Vancouver. So shout out to that. But you know, in the old days, it was still a really well designed studio for the budget we had. Like we made a lot out of nothing, let's just say. But it was a bit like being in a submarine. You know, it's like there's no windows, there's stickers all over the walls. Somebody had cut out all of these old editions of Bloom County comics and stuck them like wallpaper on all of the hallways. So, you know, it was just kind of scrappy, and you know, we have this. These production studios that are modeled precisely on the same equipment that's in the on-air studio, which is of course meant to be convenient for training and for volunteers to sort of increase their ability and their skills. But it also means that you have all of these machines that are identical, so you can do really interesting things with like three Revox reel-to-reels and running the tape across three different machines and doing these sort of tape tricks that are in many ways, the bread and butter of early electronic music also, also here in the US, like in the 60s, if we think of different organizations, like working with tape is a real moment for many artists in terms of understanding the ability to actually materially affect the sound by changing its material circumstances, literally cutting and splicing or degrading tape in different ways or changing the envelope of the sound based on how you've threaded it on the machine and what you do with it.
The speed. And
the speed, yes, exactly.
The direction, you can go backwards. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Whereas in Austria, it was in just the regular national radio station in Vienna. So it was built in the 1930s. It's this Art Deco building. You know, they're doing all of the regular radio shows. On the National Public Radio, they have a few different channels. So the Kunstradio program is housed on the cultural channel. But that still means that, you know, people are doing national radio. So they're recording symphonies. They do radio plays where they have a whole studio that just has all of the different surfaces you might want for the sound of someone running up and down stairs, or the sound of someone pouring water in a kitchen, or, you know, the sound of tiles or doors opening and closing, like a studio that's just full of all of that, plus like little homemade interesting things that simulate different kinds of doorbells or all of the stuff you might need to make a live radio play. It's a fantastic space to work in. Unfortunately, they're going to be moving that whole studio to somewhere in the suburbs of Vienna and potentially turning that ancient great building into condos, I understand, which is a bit of a horror. But there's even in the ORF studios there in Vienna, there was a reverb tank in the basement, which is to say like a concrete empty room that had audio lines running down and speakers there. So you could play your sound into this room and then record it again and send it back up to a studio.
You'd have a microphone recording the other side of the room to hear all of that reverb. I heard that.
That's right.
There's a wonderful video on the internet where it turns out Motown had something similar but smaller up in its attic. They had a metal, as long as the house could, you know, they built the metal box the length of the home recording studio that they were using to make all these Motown records, and that's the Motown reverb sound. It's just a metal box in the attic with a speaker on one side of the box and a microphone on the other that they could send the signal up to.
That's right. So this was the same idea, just it was like a room in the basement.
The Kunstradio reverb room sound.
Yeah.
There's probably a VST plugin somewhere.
Yeah. So it was really fantastic to be there. I mean, I definitely, it really changed my practice 100% to be in that situation. Because I all of a sudden, I also understood that I could make these longer pieces, that they could have this life across a number of different kinds of platforms. But I would also say that I really wanted to hang on to a more unpolished sound. And you know, the kind of work that I make is, I would say it's not terribly inaccessible, but it is not the usual thing.
What then got you interested in going from practice to understanding more of the history and the circumstance of transmission art and radio art?
Well, and I guess before I answer that question, I should also say that then transmission art, as opposed to radio art, is when artists are working across the electromagnetic spectrum, like thinking of waves, like electromagnetic waves as artistic material. And that could include AM or FM. That might include frequencies like UHF and VHF. It might include VLF and EHF, ELF frequencies. It could include microwave, could include visible light, might include, you know, radio astronomy and so on. So there's a huge broad range there, and those artists are not generally making things for broadcast, although that's kind of a subsection, you might say. But transmission art tends to be more installation based and sort of definitely more on the conceptual art side, meets this kind of material entanglement with waves. So I guess for me, I'd studied some strange things as an undergraduate in university in a very uneven way. You know, I kind of started and stopped university and sort of dropped out for periods of time and then reappeared again. So I had studied comparative religion. I studied feminist studies and media studies in particular, and international literature. So I feel like I already had this this interest in media as a broad category, and not as a visual category. I wasn't particularly interested in thinking about that. And then it was actually my experience in the studio and then the reading that I started doing around radio history that made me think, there's actually kind of a hole here. Like, there's not very much writing about experimental radio. There's actually a lot of space here to have new thoughts. Like, this is, you know, radio, in a way, especially by the late 90s, radio was relieved of the pressure of being cutting edge. There's nothing cutting edge about it at that moment. It was determinately trailing edge. So you could say, well, what's possible now that you don't have to be cool? Like, what could radio be doing if it wasn't just, like, you know, telling you the news and the information of the day, the weather, the traffic report? And in the meantime, radio had also just started automating enough that, like, there weren't as many late-night DJs. It was more common for stations, even independent stations, to start putting on pre-recorded material or just repeating shows from the day or putting on the BBC World Service or whatever overnight. And I really was insulted by this. So it's like, the nighttime listening is the most interesting. Mm-hmm. And the radio day, the 24-hour radio day, should reflect the actual circumstances of the place in which it broadcasts, which is that it's dark and it's nighttime at 2 a.m. I don't want to hear the morning show from Britain then. Like, I would like to hear something else that reflects on that mood and that sort of disposition of the space. So kind of everything I made when I started my master's, which was in media studies, was for overnight radio. I was really focused on making things for overnight radio. And that's where I sort of hatched this idea of the little people inside the radio. Like, what do they do when you turn off the radio? It had a lot to do with this idea of, like, what else could be going on overnight when you aren't listening? So.
Yeah, tell us about those overnight pieces and the little people in the radio.
So I had done some overnight radio in Vancouver at CITR. Part of being the program director is that when your programmers flunk out, someone has to go in and put things on the air, and the program director is like the final line of holding up the license. So I would get a call at 11 p.m. and somebody would say, "There's, you know, the next programmer isn't coming in, and I have to leave." And I was like, "All right, I'm on my way." So I got used to doing these, like, long form overnight shows sometimes, and kind of staging takeovers as part of projects where, you know, this station has actually been taken over by other people. Now it's a different station. It has different call letters. It is, and being interested in that kind of a kind of radio theater that's for radio. Like, we're in a radio station that's been taken over by radio pirates. You know, it's a really easy thing to do when you're in a radio station already. So
it reminds me of Negative Land that you referred to, because Don Joyce's radio show on KPFA. I just discovered in the archives that they had a thing that they would do, I think in the late 80s, where they would pretend that KPFA overnight had turned into a new pop radio superstation. And so this overnight show on KPFA, a listener-sponsored, nonprofit, anti-war, Berkeley radio station, overnight their radio show would pretend that it had become one of California's new mega hit stations, and then they would slowly subvert the expectations of
and of
what
course
you're listening to.
And put on the complaint calls, right? Patch in the calls that people were making complaining about it, and subverting that, indeed. And I think what's interesting to me as you talk about this, Anna, is that, you know, these are the sorts of things that if you find people who've done college radio and community radio, especially overnight, if they've not done it themselves, you'll hear the stories of their co-broadcasters. You know, I have a friend who has been doing overnight radio at in Central Illinois, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, for 40 years. And
Did we not interview him on Radio Survivor?
I interviewed him on Radio Survivor. Yeah, his name is Ed Hadley, right? And indeed does these sorts of things, you know, and sometimes it's more straightforward and sometimes it's less straightforward and invites people on, you know, and at some point inspired a little bit, of course, by, like, Negative Land, as you mentioned, because I think because they also recorded and released records, that gave them a, it allowed other people to hear it. You didn't have to just be in Berkeley any longer. And, but also to some extent inspired by his own impulses, his own artistic impulses, not necessarily steeped in the fact that, or aware, you know, in 1982 in the prairies of central Illinois, that maybe there's somebody else in Vancouver, you know, or in Toronto or in Madison doing something similar like that. And that it actually maybe connects to a tradition, even, you know, that that of folks who have done, who are doing radio art in the past and possibly more self-consciously. I don't know if that's the right word.
I do think self-conscious radio is what that's about. I mean, I was really interested in thinking, I was making radio to think about radio. I was really fascinated by that. And I also, I feel like a lot of the things that I have discovered through working with radio are not unique entirely to radio. Like, there is a materiality to all sorts of media. I just happen to explore that through radio, which has this tendency to be described as ephemeral, you know, where voices are described as being disembodied. And I fully disagree with those things. I mean, radio has a ton of materiality. It has a ton of infrastructure. My voice is fully embodied here, folks. Mm-hmm. Like, you're just hearing it through a very complicated collaboration with a lot of equipment, which is taking up a lot of the space of my physical self, since I'm not there with you in person right now. But also, you know, my voice comes from spending 50 years in this body, in this culture, at this time. There's a reason why it sounds this way. That's really physical. That is not ghostly. That is not ephemeral. That is not disembodied at all. You know, my experience of living in this world and this in presenting in the way that I do at this time as a strategy for expressing myself and for managing what it's like to be in this culture produces this voice now. So. And that includes also being on the radio. Like, my voice changed because I heard myself in my headphones all the time.
Yes, yes. And I, although you mentioned ephemerality, and one of the things that I enjoyed about when I was doing late night radio, which is difficult these days in the digital world where everything is sort of temporarily stored, if not permanently stored, was the fact that I could do something that one night at 1 a.m. and if I didn't record it, I had a pretty good chance it was lost.
Confident like that you could get away in the dark.
Well, right. There's a sort of like you could push the boundaries and possibly get away with something or do something that if it were done at 2 o'clock in the afternoon would raise more hackles or might, you know, you might also be just free-forming and something slips out. You're like, oh, I wouldn't say that again, or I wouldn't let that sample out again, or I wouldn't do that again. But it happened at 1 a.m. You didn't record it. No one's recording it. It's likely now just lost, and that there's both, you know, sort of the CYA part of that, but also a bit of the magic like there is in live performance, which it effectively is, just live performance in a different manner, that now it's we're not burdened by it having to be captured either.
No, that's a good point. And I mean, I guess what I was referring to was thinking about the fact that in order to broadcast a voice, like there's all of this sort of material chain of, right, of cause and effect that needs to take place that leaves traces in ways. But those are also kind of about, you know, electrons moving around. And in the old days, I guess you could say, like, you know, magnetic orientation of filings on a tape and such. Like, but you're absolutely right that the thing I do love about broadcast radio, and especially about live radio, is that maybe there isn't a recording. Actually, most of what I did in the 1990s is there's no recording of it. There's my memory of it. There's other people's memory of it, but we don't have recordings of most of it.
Yeah, and there's a power in that the youth have rediscovered, where now, you know, in the second decade of the 21st century, one of the selling points of some of these media apps is that the work is forgotten. It's temporary. It's only around for 24 hours, and then the stream goes down.
Yeah, I was just thinking that with Snapchat and with people who post things saying, I might delete this later.
So, yeah,
you know, there's some sort of freedom. and having something be temporary.
This is Radio Survivor, and we're speaking today with Anna Fritz, assistant professor of film and digital media at the University of Santa Cruz in California. We're talking about sound art and transmission arts. My name is Eric Klein. With me is Paul Riesmandel and Jennifer Waits.
And actually, sorry, Jennifer. I mean, I wanted to kind of follow up on that a little bit, and then maybe you can take that. Then the ephemerality is a challenge then, too. If you're going to try to construct histories and documents of radio art, you know, from the beginning, because you have to rely more on accounts such as they are rather than the broadcasts themselves.
That's right. It's an oral history of radio experimentation often. And in fact, I have been thinking a lot that I would like to undertake that as a project, especially for Canadian radio, kind of before people start totally disappearing or forgetting. I mean, I definitely have a sense of a number of folks who were making radio art in the 80s and 90s and into the early 2000s. And then I started moving around so much that I wasn't as up on what people were doing at various stations in Canada. And you know, it's only in the last 10 years, I would say, that some stations have really taken to heart the idea of the deep archive. And so now it is possible to search for shows and to look for shows from the past. And I feel like one could cobble together this history more easily at the moment. But, you know, this is something that I'm involved with, the Wave Farm, which is a transmission arts center based in the Catskills in New York State. And one of the things we're trying to do there is to build up this transmission arts archive that includes, as a subset of it, really radio broadcasts and thinking about radio art pieces. And we can't replay all of those in the archive. We can just write about them in some cases, because either pieces are under license restriction because they come from different sorts of radio ecologies, you might say. And in other cases, it's like the piece no longer exists, but we can talk to the people about the piece. So it's a difficulty of trying to string together, like, what were people doing? And especially for the Europeans, whenever I'm in a context like in Germany, let's say, or other countries that have had pretty robust experimental radio scenes, in their national public radio system, like France, for instance, they're always really surprised that North America, where we effectively don't have state radio, and where people made everything for free, you know, because no volunteer on an independent station got paid for radio art. How on earth did that happen here? Like, why did so much radio art, especially, come out of Canada? And, you know, my explanation for that was, well, we licensed independent radio really early, and we were tied to, and those stations had strong ties to artist-run culture. So in Vancouver, there's not just CITR, there's also Co-op Radio, which is more famous for being the place where Hildegard Westerkamp and Hank Bull and Patrick Reddy and some other folks who were also associated either with the World Soundscape Project and R. Murray Schafer, or associated with the Western Front and Fluxus, like those shows were already rolling in the 80s. We already had this possibility, even in one city where there were two stations that were able to do a lot of experimentation. And there was certainly some cross-pollination there, with CITR kind of being more the noise locus and Co-op being a bit more, having a little more influence from the sort of composerly side of things. But you could also say that there was a big difference between East Coast and West Coast. So stations in Montreal and Toronto that had a much larger reach earlier, they also had this scene that was tied to conceptual art and sound art. And again, you know, I feel like some artists from there were a bit better known in some circles, whereas Vancouver really came from a kind of scrappy place of noise. And so we didn't always cross over in the same scenes, even if we could all be technically thought of as working in radio art. So it'd be really interesting, I think, to try to write up some of these histories from the North American perspective, where, there was a lot of activity, but it really would involve some sleuthing, I think, to track folks down at this point.
Yeah, I love that you're thinking about working on that. And I'm also curious about the the predecessors to all of that. And I saw you give an amazing presentation where you talked about the very, very early history of radio art and transmission art. And we've been talking mostly about this more recent history from the 80s forward. But I'm wondering if you could take us back for a little bit to talk about these very early years and what you've learned in your research about the early days of radio art and transmission art.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like in the very early days, if we think of the late 1920s, so when the first sort of radio stations are licensed or there's something that resembles a radio program that's officially being broadcast, then you have interesting examples like in Mexico City, the Estudiantistas, who were a group of poets and literary sort of literary artists. Definitely tied to a kind of early avant-garde. They got their hands on the radio and were thinking of it as a place to put forward these new forms of poetic expression. So not necessarily so much with music, more about what we would now think of as sound poetry or a kind of very free-form poetry.
Tell us their name again.
The Estridentistas. And then at the same time, we have an avant-garde in Europe, in various countries who don't have access to the radio, but are really excited about what the radio might do and what it might offer. And that viewpoint is very influenced by kind of which national culture these artists are embedded in terms of what they're resisting or what they are amplifying. So, for instance, the Italian futurists famously wrote manifestos about radio and what it might be. Marinetti writes La Radia together with Pino Masnada, which is a manifesto often quoted for saying that, you know, the radio will be this a bit like it will offer this opportunity to, in a way, like transcend our bodies and move into a more cosmic relationship with vibrations, with other cosmic forces. But I would also say that manifesto begins with a fairly damning list of things that, you know, we have overcome, you know, we have overcome women, we have overcome, like, war is mankind's only hygiene, etc. Like, there's a lot of very distasteful and frankly racist ideas that are also hiding in that manifesto. And that's not usually the section that's quoted when people talk about La Radia. They usually stick to the more, you know, exclamatory, sort of like ecstatic aspect of it. But it is worth remembering that those ideas at that time were sort of deeply about an avant-garde excitement about the emergent forms of modernism that included automobility, also included forms of warfare. It also included ideas of power and masculinity. So, you know, radio is seen as being sort of circulating in there. And whereas the Russian futurists, and specifically I'm thinking of Vladimir Klebnikov, who was a poet who never came anywhere near a radio station, died very early, actually, was still in his 20s, but wrote this really lovely piece called The Radio of the Future. And The Radio of the Future, he imagines that people will be able to read books wirelessly that are projected somehow on clouds. You know, I mean, now when we're sort of in our current age of the internet, it's like, well, he had a lot of ideas that were not super far away from the sorts of, you know, in a metaphorical sense, from the structures that are part of our everyday now. But Klebnikov also had this idea that the radio should do something good for the collective, and it should be about learning for the collective. And as a result, one would need to also protect the radio because it's incredibly powerful and you can't just let it loose for anyone to control. I mean, that's sort of an ongoing theme in many of these early writings, is both this desire to get access to the radio, which was denied in Europe. I mean, in the early days of radio, in North America, it was for-profit radio that is our origin, and in Europe it is state radio, and in Europe it's because people, politicians and so on, powers that be, really were concerned that malignant actors would want to use the radio for propaganda, would brainwash the population. And that was frankly also a worry in the United States. I mean, this is the foundation of communication studies, is the concern that new forms of broadcast media will broadcast propaganda that will control the population in a populistic sense. And they will not have the common sense or the critical faculties to be able to kind of read that media. So it seems like a kind of familiar refrain at this moment. But of course, they also find out that people aren't as duped as you think. It has a lot more to do with what your neighbors have to say and what's being repeated around you and your surroundings, and not only what you're getting from the media. But these different forms of dispersal really influence who has access to the radio. So all of these artists who are writing in Europe, like in Italy and Russia, they don't have access to the radio necessarily. It's not until after World War II, really, in places like Britain, in England, in France, where you see the beginnings of these experimental studios, these like small laboratories of folks working who also have the opportunity to experiment with equipment and kind of invent radiophonic instruments, you might say, like early electronic instruments. So the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, the GRM studio in Paris that's run by Pierre Schaeffer, who's a musique concrète composer. Like, these are spaces that become really important for the European scene, and they tie very closely to a kind of emerging avant-garde conception of making work in those countries. And here, it's not that there was an absence of that. It's entirely. It's just that we just don't have a record of it because it wasn't being institutionally supported. So it's all about what people were doing on the fly.
You've talked a bit about women and women's voices, and I know that they were a big part of some of these radiophonic workshops too. So maybe tell us a bit about some of these women who were, you know, early on really important to this practice.
Right. Well, I mean, the great example is, of course, Delia Derbyshire, who was the person who composed the Doctor Who theme, and also among other things. And what was so great about her practice is that she was very deeply working with reel-to-reel players. She would have all of these sounds that she had created, often through a sort of fully studio process of recording the sounds of, like, you know, knocking wood together or brushing a brush across a piece of metal, or just, you know, different sorts of acoustic sounds. She would record those onto tape and then manipulate the tape in a variety of ways to quite, you know, quite radically transform those sounds. And then, you know, she worked a lot with loops. She would have like 8 or 9 of these tape machines lined up, and then would just synchronize her performance of these different sounds, you know, multi-tracking them onto tape eventually, but in the early days, just trying to synchronize performing from the recorders according to a score in order to produce super interesting sounds. And I mean, I've seen, there's a great documentary about her where they also speak to a number of experimental music artists and kind of like alternative music artists of the 70s and 80s who grew up listening to Delia Derbyshire's recordings and like her sort of incidental sound on BBC. And it completely led them into the music that they themselves would produce later.
I have a question about her workplace conditions. Like, Delia Derbyshire was employed by the BBC to make really far out there art, and then they sometimes would use that in their more like mainstream broadcasts. You know, Doctor Who. Did it start on the radio?
No. Yeah.
Doctor Who on the radio is a radio play. Like, people listen to radio plays. They don't have to be avant-garde listeners to understand it. And yet her work goes into that and sort of you know, creates mainstream art out of this avant-garde. Was that the plan? Was that why she was hired by the BBC?
I think it's just they had a small group of people working together, and she had the opportunity to join that group of people, and over time really evolved a style. And I would say at the same time, electroacoustic music is becoming more popular, and so there's, you know, there's synergies there too. But I don't know. I mean, I could tell you a scholar who studied the BBC radio radiophonic workshop in great detail who would be the person to speak with.
Because I'm just wondering if like her artwork had radio airtime when it was weird, as opposed to when it was mainstream, and that there those two types of broadcasts. You know, she was paid to do both. Is what I'm assuming.
I mean, she was, I think the great thing is that what she made, like she consistently made the kind of sounds that she made, and those were, as you say, they were incorporated into just kind of everyday aspects of the radio, as well as being part of, like, you know, this science fiction radio play, Doctor Who. So
yeah, I forgot.
I don't have the impression that she did a whole lot of stuff that was super boring. I think she mostly was noodling around making interesting sounds.
I forgot that when Doctor Who first aired, it would not have been a mainstream radio product, but it would have been extremely niche, just as niche, perhaps, as, you know, electronic synthesizer music.
But there was also this interest in, like, what's the sound of the future? So, you know, there's still a formalism to that kind of experimentation, and maybe in some ways it seemed less risky than other kinds of experimentation. I don't know how long it took those same radio stations to appreciate, like, scratch DJing, for instance. So, you know, one could definitely do some interesting research into that to think about, like, depending on who is doing the experimenting, who is accepted sooner. You know, Delia Derbyshire's, like, as a woman was an outlier in this, but she's also a white woman. And so, you know, she was still sort of inside of some of the conventions of musical music making and tonality and so on that were, you know, maybe not as maybe not challenging in the same way that, let's say, the Beatles were, or like other bands that were drawing on, you know, historically sort of black musical forms coming from the United States. So I'm not enough of an expert in the British radio and music scene to be able to unpack all of that, but she's still a really interesting character. And another person who comes a little bit after her is Daphne Oram, who created a fantastic system of making electronic music that was based on visual notation. So her system she called Oramics, and it's actually a kind of tabletop. Well, it forms like a whole sort of table-sized machine, where she would be able to draw, like, make sort of gestural drawings of different sorts of shapes, and then those would be sonified. So those would become the sound, in a way. So she would create visual marks on this transparent surface, and then light would read it in a way and create these sounds that would you would then hear. And her machine is actually often on display in the in London, in the Museum of Science. So I have spotted it there on occasion.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you've talked a bit about radio studios as instruments, and now you're sort of getting into this area of folks who are also creating instruments that use transmission. So maybe talk a little bit. I mean, I'm thinking about the theremin, for example. Maybe talk a little bit about that, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the theremin and the Ondes Martineau are the two instruments that are definitively radiophonic instruments. So Leon Theremin, Lev Theremin, is from Russia. And in the early 1920s, he debuts this new instrument that can be played without touching it. That I should also say he has a background as a cello player, which is, of course, a fretless instrument. So he's already someone who was used to finding a tone along a very smooth string. And and he was someone who had been a radio operator during World War I. So he had that training of tuning in and listening. And if we're talking about radio operating in, you know, the 19-teens, that's a world where there's a lot of unstable frequencies. Like, if you're listening for something, you are constantly listening to these tones that swoop up and down, that are these sort of glissando tones, you know, that kind of typical, like, woo, sort of like spooky sound now because of the theremin, but that you can also hear if you're working with shortwave radio. So Theremin figures out that he can create an instrument he's actually meant to be working on other kinds of devices. He's trying to create a device that will be able to indicate if there's, you know, chemical changes in a reaction and so on. Like he discovers by accident that he's making a musical instrument. And what it is that there are two different small oscillators, and one of those is stable and one of those is movable. And the proximity of a body part, like the hand, for instance, to near the antenna, which might be a pitch antenna or could be a volume antenna, will change the relationship of these two oscillators such that you have either you can go from a low tone if your hand is far away to a very high tone the closer your hand is to the antenna. And the same thing with the volume. The closer your hand is to the antenna, the quieter the sound is, and the further your hand is away, then it can become louder within the sort of field of influence of the device. So Theremin starts, he imagines that this instrument will replace the voice or the violin in the orchestra, and that it will allow people to play this sort of very early electronic instrument. So he brings it to the United States to try to sell it, and he finds himself a muse in the form of Clara Rockmore, who is this young violin player who's excellent at violin playing, but also turns out to be a super prodigy of the theremin. And so she's the one that you often see associated with these early theremin concerts. And the theremin was manufactured, I believe it's by RCA, as a device in a cabinet. It kind of looked like a lectern with this straight antenna coming up the top and then a kind of smaller antenna off the side, which would allow a person to play by gesture. So it's this super interesting instrument that uses this principle of radio technology and also uses the fact that the body has capacitance, is able to enter into the circuit with this radiophonic technology and have a kind of material effect that produces a sound.
You can still buy theremins from Sweetwater catalog to this very day. They're still being made. He also made a theremin that's less well known that was for dancers to dance inside of.
Mm-hmm.
So that,
yeah, that's right.
A dancer could be making their own musical accompaniment with their body.
The tricky thing with the theremin, of course, is that though it's gestural, you would sort of imagine you'd have all this freedom. You don't have to make all of these small movements on the strings of a violin or a cello. But in order to keep your sounds in tune, you have to incredibly restrict your physical gestures such that you make these micro moves with just parts of your fingers in order to know how to control certain tones.
You have to control your breath in order to manipulate the micro movements of your hands.
So it can be kind of hard to play the theremin if you want to produce tones, like very musical kind of tones. And it does look a bit strict because people don't move their bodies very much while they're playing it. The Onde Martineau is actually built on the same principles invented by a French former radio operator who then also in the 1920s found himself creating an instrument based on very similar principles to the theremin. But Martineau was interested in having a little more control over the musicality of and the reliability of tones. So he created a kind of keyboard as a measure so that you could sort of find your place along in your relationship to the instrument and be more certain that you were hitting a C when you wanted to hit a C. And there's also a kind of wire involved in that case, so it's not completely wireless. So and there's a set of expression knobs, so you can change the envelope of the sound. And finally, he also created a series of speakers that have different properties. So there's a speaker that sort of looks like a lute with strings attached to the front, or one that has a plate to make more sort of plate reverb. And basically these allow, all of these give you this instrument that acoustically, it's like an electronic instrument that also has these acoustic aspects to it that allow you to make like really quite fabulous sounds.
Anna Fritz, you are assistant professor of film and digital media at the University of California in Santa Cruz. You're on Radio Survivor today talking about transmission arts and art on the radio and sound art. We have about 9 minutes left for the radio show before we begin our podcast. I wonder if you could talk about how radio art has one of the most unique things, I think, about making art at a radio station as opposed to making art anywhere else is how it is in relation to the listener, because of what a radio station is to its listeners. You know, it's just so different. I wonder if that's informed the history of this art form over the one century that radio has been around.
I would say yes. I mean, in terms of radio art, when you're in a broadcast scenario where you can't, as a person making it, you don't necessarily see the listeners. You don't see all the situations in which listening is taking place. Nonetheless, you have to figure out how to communicate, how to offer something. But the way I sort of think of it is that in that case, the circumstances of broadcast are very stable, because usually you're part of a station that has a license, it has you know, a reliable signal, people know where to find it on the dial, it's not moving around because we have FM stabilizers. So that's a fairly stable situation. What's unstable is you have no idea when people tune in or tune out or what else they're doing. But when I work with radio transmission outside of the studio, so when I make installations or performances where I'm using lots of small transmitters and receivers, the radius of broadcast is very small, and so I can usually see everybody who could possibly pick up the signal. So the circumstances of listening are something that I share with the listeners. I can get to know them. I can walk over and talk to them. But the instability there is about the kind of physical means of transmission. Because the signal is so small, it's affected by other stations being nearby, electrical fields, people's bodies walking between the transmitter and a receiver, and so on. So I really like that those are sort of different ways in which this instability manifests itself. But I do feel like it's an aspect, a kind of characteristic of radio, that there's always an instability somewhere in this circuit of relationship that takes place over distance.
And Anna, maybe as we conclude, can you talk a bit about what's exciting you about transmission art and radio art in 2021 during this strange, unstable time that we're in?
I mean, I think what's great is that so many people are interested in radio again. And I mean, I feel like I've been saying this for maybe 10 or 15 years, that there's only more interest in radio. Like, more people in the United States want low power FM licenses, not even to do anything weird, just because they want to have community radio. You want to have radio that's more local. At the same time, there is this boom internationally, and this is not just a sort of Western, you know, a Euro, North American centric thing, but like really internationally, there are all of these projects that use radio as temporary platforms for artistic activity and weaving radio into existing sound or media art or music festivals. So I can think of projects that take place in Scotland, like in Radiofrenia in Glasgow, that happens now about every 18 months, or Radio Tsunami in Chile, in Valparaiso, which is part of a sound art festival that happens every year. And this year, during the pandemic, they went to a fully radio-focused broadcast model. There's other projects that have been really long-running, like Radio Sona in Ljubljana in Slovenia, where they're able to get, from the government, they're able to get for very cheap a temporary frequency for 10 days just for artistic experimentation that covers the whole city of Ljubljana. Also, there are projects like P-Node based out of Paris and Mulhouse in France, which began as a completely dispersed sort of hacker-led effort to make radio out of networks of very small transmitters. And they also now have brought that into an online platform where like lots and lots of different folks can stream simultaneously. And that became the space that kind of housed this large scale international collaboration that I was doing last year during the pandemic, called the Kuch Collective, where we were, you know, doing these telematic exchanges where we had 15 of us making radio together. But that might not sound so remarkable, but when you're doing it all from home and you're not sitting with radio studios that don't, you know, that are delay free, we were all dealing with very different levels of delay and ability to hear one another. And still we were able to perform live together, you know, fully improvised together, just based on kind of creating this listening ecology and just participating in it as a way to make the show. So I feel very optimistic about the future for radio. And, you know, in the last 5 years, a group of us have been also talking about, you know, we should hang on to FM for culture. So the reason I say that is, you know, in North America, FM is in no danger of going anywhere. But in Europe, there's no AM radio already. AM is already more or less off the air. And the idea is to move towards digital and satellite models for radio distribution. So as that's happening more and more, we were like, well, why don't we save the FM spectrum for culture? So meaning it's for artist use, for cultural use. So we were using this as a kind of sub theme with this radio art festival that I was one of the co-curators of in 2016, called Radio Revolten. So Radio Revolten, which was an international radio art festival in Halle in Germany. And our kind of sub interest was FM for culture. Like maybe it should be a UNESCO preserved heritage site. Like let's preserve the FM band for culture, so it can't just be kind of capriciously made defunct and then sold for data transfer or whatever else happens to defunct frequencies these days. So I feel like that's really interesting to me, that there is such a boom in making radio. But the problem I think that persists is that people still think of radio as like a conduit for their content. And for me, radio is not just about content. Like radio is about making a relationship to something, even if it's temporary. And so that can still be music or weather or whatever, but I don't think of it as just being like, we're sending this content down the pipe to the listener, and if they've received the content, then all is good. It's like we're actually building up relationships that are intermingled with other kinds of relationships that we have, you know, that include, you know, our neighbors and our sort of political space and our, you know, our incidental meetings on the street and so on.
Yeah, I want to add to that like I would say that what radio can be right now is a way for us to relate to one another in a community that we're not selling anything to each other. We're not buying anything from each other. We're not renting. We're not owning. We're creating something together in a space, in a collective space. And, you know, the pandemic has turned all of that into an individual room and an individual microphone. But hopefully in the years that follow our pandemic, we get to come back together and share spaces with one another, share radio stations, create community that is centered around whatever we do with these radio stations, whether we talk into microphones to tell stories or whether we create sound art. That's what radio is for, as far as I'm concerned.
And I also think that, you know, we kind of get into this mode of expecting that a medium is supposed to radically transform our consciousness and our society, you know, the way that the early avant-garde thought it would. And instead it's like, why don't you think about what this medium could amplify or enhance, or how it could tweak something that's already potentially present. I feel like in the 90s, we were really scrabbling for access. It was really hard to get access. And in the United States, there was a huge pirate radio boom because it was very difficult to have a low power station legally. And so lots of people made low power stations illegally in response to the disappearance of community and local radio. But what backfired is a little bit from that era, I would say, is that we were really focused on, we need more senders. Everyone should be a sender. Everybody should be, you are the media, make the media, you should be the media. Well, now we kind of have that, you know, in terms of social media. Every damn person is airing their thought. But I think what we kind of forgot with that is the other sort of not opposite, but necessary counterpoint, which is actually everyone is a listener. Like we need to begin from the perspective of everyone is a listener. And one of the things I've written about a lot is the idea of like, what is radio that listens and that is sharing its listening? So it's like saying, what did we choose to pay attention to? And what are we sharing in terms of what we think is important around a quality of attention? So I'm trying to hold on to that a lot lately. It's like, what is it to be in a, not just in a kind of transmission ecology that includes a lot of different stations and a lot of different kinds of two-way radio use and internet use and so on, but also how do I cultivate this quality of the listener as the pinnacle, as the foremost element?
I think that's a beautiful place to conclude. Anna Friz, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Survivor today.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Can I pick up one breadcrumb you left? I think you probably have a couple minutes, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. I can go a little bit longer.
Yeah, you mentioned Tetsuo Kogawa.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's wonderful. So, why don't you tell us more about Tetsuo Kogawa and why his work ended up being influential.
So Tetsuo Kogawa is a media theorist who in the 80s in Japan started building very small transmitters as a response to this lack of access to radio that many people experience in most countries, because, you know, it's considered something that the average person is not meant to do. You're not meant to start your own radio station. And so Tetsuo was interested in the potential in places like Tokyo and Kyoto, where you had, people living in very high density in apartment buildings, where a very small transmitter might not cover a lot of physical space. But within that physical space, however small, there's still quite a lot of people. And also he was interested in what kind of relations might evolve if we were making radio together, you know, in a space of a kind of cultural space that's quite reserved. So he called his station Radio Home Run, and started a kind of mini FM boom in the 80s, where there were like quite a lot of people initially through his students and his his colleagues, of building these very small transmitters, just sort of 1 or 2 watts of FM, which, you know, maybe can cover, I don't know, in an ideal situation with an attuned antenna, maybe you could do part of a kilometer, I say, says the Canadian who doesn't know what that is in miles. But, you know, it's not a very big area. Maybe you can do a city block in ideal circumstances. If there's a lot of concrete, maybe you can just do a few floors in your apartment building. But if that's 20 apartments, that's already kind of interesting. And so the other aspect is that he invited people to make radio together. So it wasn't just people listening each in their bubble to the radio. They were also invited to come over to the apartment where the station was and to hold radio parties. And so the idea of the radio party is that by making radio together, you are able to have a different kind of conversation than you would if you were just sitting around with a beer in your hand. Because there's a way of listening, there's a way of conversing maybe. People also get inspired to maybe speak in ways they might not otherwise. They say things that are unusual. They take up topics that might not be the topic you would just casually discuss at a party otherwise. And so Tetsuo also was in contact with folks like some of the former members of Radio Alice from Italy, which also included various theorists like Felix Guattari, Ivan Illich and others. So, he definitely had a certain amount of, I would say, kind of philosophical capital as well as, you know, just a kind of cultural capital from that. So by the late 90s, when I was building a transmitter based on these plans, they had been adapted by Bobby Kosnuck at the Western Front for Canadian, sort of the parts that were available in Canada. And we were able in a workshop of a day to build the transmitter and then the next day to build the antenna. And since then, I would say after the sort of early 2000s, Tetsuo kind of had like another heyday where he was touring constantly, giving these transmitter workshops just all over the world and at different artist-run spaces. But also he himself began to be very critical of the idea of radio art. He was like, well, that's just more content. He wanted to really make art with radio. So he started doing performances where he would build the transmitters potentially on stage as part of his show, because he could build them so quickly. And he would tune them all to the same frequency. And then we have radios that were also tuned to those frequencies. And he would start turning on these antennas and what happened, or these transmitters. And what happens is that you get all sorts of crazy interference sounds. So it builds up like this potentially very noisy, very vital, really active kind of soundscape. And then he could also shape that soundscape by moving them around and also using his hands. So he began to think of that as a kind of, I would say in a way, it was a little bit like a very anarchic theremin, because he was using his hand as the main sort of fundamental metric of the space. You know, like it's like at the hand level, the area broadcast is a tabletop. But once it was amplified through speakers, it turns into this like kind of spectacular sound world. So so for Tetsuo, he really started seeing a big difference between art for radio, and then for him, radio art is manipulating frequencies and manipulating transmission directly, and is not about sending any kind of signal over.